The China Global South podcast is supported in part by the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg and by our subscribers. Thank you. If you'd like to subscribe for daily news and exclusive analysis about every aspect of China's engagement in Africa, Asia, and throughout the developing world, go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China Global South podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander in Ho Chi Minh City, and today we're going to talk about a topic that I have been wanting to discuss for months and months and months about the Chinese auto industry, because this is a topic that in the Global South and also in the US and Europe is causing a lot of excitement, obviously for some very different reasons. Regular listeners to the show will also know that we've been covering the EV battery metal market. Some people call it critical resources, critical minerals. And you know, over the past year, the prices of cobalt, lithium, nickel have just cratered. I mean, just plummeted. And it's remarkable. Now, there's a whole geopolitical discussion about battery metals that we'll have another day, but the reason why, at least in part, these battery metals are such weak pricing right now is because demand for EVs in China and in the United States, and even to some extent in some parts of Europe, is going down. Amazing statistic by McKinsey China that shows really some major disillusionment among Chinese EV car owners in 2023. 22% said they would not consider buying another, what they call, new energy vehicle for their next car. And that number was just 3% in 2022. That same fatigue we're seeing in the United States. Now, here in Asia, also in the Americas, certainly in places like the Middle East, that is not the case. And one of the things that we're seeing is a big uptick in EV sales in the Global South. Let me just give you some updates on BYD alone. And if you're not familiar with BYD, this is a company that you really need to follow. So build your dreams. It is partially invested by Warren Buffett, and it is on a tear now. It is the largest EV manufacturer in the world, even ahead of Tesla. They just launched a new version of their top-selling Atto 3 in overseas market, and it's priced at just over $16,000. And that's really one of the competitive advantages of the Chinese in developing countries, is that they're not selling EVs as a luxury product. Now, in Mexico, they've just started selling the Seagull, which is a five-door compact electric hatchback priced at $21,000, and that gets you 305 kilometers of range on a full charge. But to be sure, they're also in the upscale market. BYD India just launched the sedan called the Seal, and that's priced between $50,000 and $64,000, putting that closer into Tesla territory. Now, in order to service all of those new markets, BYD and other Chinese manufacturers are starting to set up factories all over the world. In Thailand alone, BYD and other Chinese EV companies have just built out huge manufacturing operations. In fact, total capacity now stands today at 730,000 EVs per year that they can produce in Thailand. Now, that sounds impressive, but it's even more staggering when you consider that last year alone, only 100,000 EVs were sold throughout Southeast Asia. So you're seeing just massive overcapacity. And it's not entirely sure if the demand is going to be there, because in countries like Vietnam, where I'm at, we don't have the charging infrastructure, both at home or public charging places throughout the city, say in Saigon or in Hanoi. So it's really interesting to see where these EVs are going to go. BYD is also setting up manufacturing operations in Hungary, in Indonesia, also here in Vietnam. And they're also apparently scoping out locations in Mexico. And it's that last country, in Mexico, that's causing just a whole lot of panic in the United States. In fact, I don't know if you heard this, the Alliance for American Manufacturing issued a report last month that said low-cost Chinese EVs made in Mexico would be, quote, an extinction-level event. That sentiment is widely shared in many parts of the United States, especially in Washington. And just a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump, at a campaign rally in Ohio, he warned what would happen if Chinese EVs are allowed to be brought in over the border from Mexico, and he also said what he'll do about it if reelected.
Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Lot of people in Washington are getting worked up about the prospect of Chinese EVs coming in under the North American Free Trade Agreement, as you've seen from Donald Trump. There are also some dissenting voices here. Now, Jorge Guardo, for those of you in the China watching space, you'll know who that is. He's the former Mexican ambassador to China and a well-known China watcher. Last year, he told an audience at the Aspen Institute of Ideas Festival that Americans have nothing to worry about.
China has a huge lead on electric vehicles by far, and everybody acknowledges it. Europe has a mandate that they will phase out the internal combustion by 2035. Will they allow Chinese manufacturers to come to Europe and pretty much overtake the European car manufacturers or not? That won't happen in the United States. If a Chinese car manufacturer tried to set up shop in the United States, there would be congressional hearings, there would be accusations of spying, you know. So it's not happening in the United States, it's happening in other parts of the world. And I think we miss the big picture when we just focus on the U.S.-China relationship. So that's my point of view as a Mexican watching.
And Jorge has been on Twitter really trying to hammer this point home. And he's been really interesting because, again, he has been a contrarian voice in the panic that's really starting to settle in the United States about the thought that Chinese EVs made in Mexico could come in under the North American Free Trade Agreement, sidestepping the current 27% tariff. Now, here's something that Jorge wrote the other day. He said the idea that China is sidestepping U.S. tariffs through Mexico is narrative-based, not data-based. He says part of our, quote, immigrant invasion coming through southern border, unquote, fentanyl from Mexico killing our children, unquote, and now, quote, China using Mexico political narrative. So it's really hard to sort out what's happening here. Chinese EVs, though, are a force that we're going to have to deal with all over the world, for better and for worse, depending on where you're sitting. And so I thought it'd be great to get somebody who knows a lot more about this than I do. And for that, I'm just thrilled to have on the show Lei Xing, who is the host of China EVs and More podcast. He's got 20 years of experience covering the Chinese auto sector, including a stint as chief editor of the China Automotive Review. He also does quite a bit of independent consulting about Chinese automotive trends. And I'm thrilled to welcome him to the show today. A very good morning to you, Lei. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you, Eric, for having me. That was a long lead.
It was a long lead, but it requires a setup for people because this is a really complex issue that I think a lot of people aren't following, especially if you're in the U.S. You may be following what's happening in the U.S., but unaware of what's happening here in Vietnam, Indonesia, Mexico. BYD and the Chinese companies are a force to be reckoned with. We haven't even talked about South Africa, where Chinese companies like Chery and Haval and Great Wall Motors are killing it. I mean, they're in the top 10 now, displacing some of the Korean, Japanese, and European brands, and even some of the Americans. So let's start first in China, okay, so we can get our head around what's happening. I said at the beginning, there was this concern from Chinese automakers that sales are slowing there. So in order to keep their volumes up, they're looking overseas now to expand. That's been one of the old playbooks that the Chinese have used for a long time. Give us a sense of what your read is today of the Chinese EV market domestically before we look at internationally.
Well, there's two things going on. There's this kind of I would describe it as not a slowdown, but if we were talking about the China EV market going at 100 miles per hour before, and the rest of the world were going at 50 miles per hour trying to catch up. Now China's kind of going 70, 80 miles per hour, but the rest of the world seems to be stalling. I think that's the way I would describe it, the kind of the market situation. But the two things going on is, well, naturally for any auto market, now they're trying to become this powerhouse of not only autos, but pretty clearly EVs, that it would be natural to expand globally. That's the same for the US automakers, it's the same for the Japanese, for the Koreans, for the Europeans. So that's number one. But number two, given the kind of the growth over the pandemic, I think we need to really talk about some of the factors why there was so much growth. And I would think of three, and this will be successive. So from 2020 is the year when Giga Shanghai Tesla started production of the Model 3. I think that was one of the catfish effect, so-called. In 2021, a small Wuling Hongguang Mini EV was launched that quickly popularized the micro A00 segment. And that segment is 100% battery electric vehicles.
Okay, let me just stop you there, because I think there might be some jargon there that some of our listeners may not understand. So number one is Wuling is a joint venture with General Motors, no less, right?
Yes, that's correct. The SAIC GM Wuling, yes.
Yeah, so GM actually has a stake in this. And then you've talked about this A00, which is the smallest class. And these are popular, by the way, also in Indonesia. The Wuling has just started in Indonesia, and they've been a first mover there. And they've done very well. So these are these tiny little cars, right? I mean, really micro cars, if some almost.
It's almost like a golf car-sized EV. And then in 2022, obviously, we talked about BYD, is when BYD announced in March 2022 that they stopped production of pure, you know, ICE-driven vehicles, internal combustion engine. So these three things, plus, you know, China was nearing the end of subsidies, which ended at the end of 2022. So all of these factors combined, I think, pushed the market, plus the pandemic. You know, people wanted to have their own cars and EVs, the number of models launching. So, and now you built this capacity. There's so many brands. There's still brands. This coming Beijing Auto Show.
Dozens, right? I mean, we're talking.
Yeah. I look at my hands like, yeah, there's a handful of brands still launching. And we're in 2024. So you have this glut and you have this drive to go global. That's why now how I describe it was more recently, the Western world seems to have woken up to this. If you want to call it the China threat, you know, we can talk about that a little bit later. I probably will be on middle ground between Trump and the guy, Guardado.
Well, let me get your take on Mexico in a second, but let me just still want to stay in China before we go overseas.
Sure.
The adoption of EVs in China, though, wasn't organic and it wasn't consumer driven. In many cases, as you said, there were subsidies, but also if you wanted to get a license plate, which is effectively the equivalent of registering your car. In cities like Shenzhen, you couldn't get one if you had a gas-powered car. At some point, they said only EVs. In cities like Shanghai, they gave preference to EVs. They lowered the cost of the registration. Also, the license plate in a city like Shanghai determines where you can go in the city in terms of can you go on the highways at certain times and whatnot. And EVs got preference. Lots of public policy behind the push for EVs. They also had this amazing infrastructure, I mean, charging networks everywhere, which, of course, made it really convenient. That's the problem we're facing in California, is that people have bought EVs, but they were kind of told that you can charge it all over the place, but really they should have been told that this is a charge-at-home type of product. And so there's been a lot of frustrations with the U.S. charging network here in Vietnam. Just seeing the first chargers come out, but China went all in on that infrastructure, and that really helped a lot. So talk a little bit about the adoption, because in the West and in other markets, they're depending on consumers to drive this, not public policy. But in China, public policy played a critical role.
Exactly. And it's important to point out that the rise of the China EVs, the take rate, or the, you know, it didn't happen over the pandemic. It happened over a period of time of educating the market, of building out this infrastructure, which is all standardized. So any type of EVs can be charged at any type of these chargers that are in place. And I had that experience when I was in China for 2 months last summer. I drove quite a few different EVs, and every different type of, whether it was Shell, whether it was one of these joint venture, locally, third party, state-owned, state grid, Star Charge, all of these charging operators, the only thing you needed to do was scan and plug and charge. And so it's not like in the US where all of these automakers now having to adapt to the Tesla's NACS in order to enjoy their supercharging network. So there's no hassle there. I think that's a very important part of reason why the EVs have grown so much in China, not only because of the availability of these tech feature rich, but also the infrastructure availability. I think all of these factors, plus the, you know, the subsidy system that were in place actually since 2014 is when they started the subsidy system, which ended in 2022.
The subsidies that you're talking about are consumer subsidies.
Yes.
That's right. Now, let's transition now to the really, really sensitive issue of the manufacturing subsidies. And that is the issue that the European Union, the United States, and a number of other countries are very concerned about, that it's not fair, in their view, that Chery, BYD, now Xiaomi, for example, the battery makers like CATL, have access to subsidies for electricity, for water, for rent on their factories, any number of types of industrial subsidies that give them an unfair advantage against BMW, VW, Ford, GM, that don't get these kinds of subsidies. And one of the reasons why the American Alliance for American Manufacturing said it was an extinction level event is because of these subsidies. Now, the European Union is looking into this, but China is well known for subsidizing its critical industries. What is your understanding of the level of industrial subsidies for Chinese EV manufacturers and battery makers as well?
Well, if you look at, let's say, the BYDs, these public listed companies, every year they would report how much the type of subsidies they would get from the government. And these are quite significant value that contributes to their, you know, profitability. Without these subsidies, they probably cannot, you know, launch these vehicles at the competitive pricing that they have. So yes, I think I understand the Western world, the Europe, the US, the concern on this subsidization. But I think from another perspective, at the end of the day, I think if we look at China, I mean, in all of their, it's a very top down, right? You have these industrial policies, you have the Made in China 2025, you have the auto industry policy, that the drive to become a kind of a powerhouse, these are the factors or part of the, you know, the tactics that they would use.
Yeah, but in fairness, then, do you blame the Europeans and the Americans to want to protect themselves against what are considered unfair trade subsidies?
Yeah. Do you blame China?
I mean, that's fair too.
Yeah. So I think it's difficult to have a right or wrong side on this. I think that's what China does. I think not only in the auto industry, but other industries as well. And we've seen this happen in the photovoltaics, the right, solar panels. But I think it's only a means to drive the competitiveness of these companies while, I think, educating the market. So it's hard to, you know, put a, you know, right or wrong on this.
Well, I guess that depends where you sit, because if you are in the United States and you're among the hundreds of thousands of people who work in the U.S. auto industry, it's not hard at all to figure out what that is. Same with Europe. I mean, you try to look at a country like Germany, whose auto industry is absolutely essential to its economy, that China is a threat. And again, this question of fair, there are rules of international trade, and you're not allowed to subsidize like that and then compete against companies that are not subsidized.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, we also overlook the fact that aside from the subsidies, that there's this innovative and the speed of these technologies being available, starting to appear on these vehicles and attuned to the customer taste. I think in that aspect, aside from the subsidies, there's also market forces at play. I think that contributed to the Chinese kind of leaping ahead the past 40 years before the pandemic. It was the foreign automakers' playground, right? And now, you know, it's the foreign automakers that are catching up. Partially subsidies, yes, well, but
a lot of people even think that the foreign automakers aren't going to survive in China that much longer because they're not competitive.
Yeah, but they are producing locally. I mean, the consumer subsidies, they enjoy these subsidies. But it's the speed, it's the type of products that come out. I think there's both elements at play. There's market forces, speed, subsidization. And the consumer really also may be part of it. I don't know if we want to go into this nationalistic. Now you see these younger, new generation consumers. They don't really have a brand loyalty or taste for a specific type of world-renowned brand. Anything in China, that's why these new brands that come out, they'll have a market. The Xiaomi's, right, as an example. I think a lot of factors are at play in how kind of this script was flipped.
Yeah. I mean, that's not just in cars, but coffee and a number of other products as well, where the young generation wants to choose Chinese-made brands, and the luster of a foreign brand just isn't quite what it was a few years ago. Let's move abroad a little bit in our discussion. Let's start in Mexico about this concern that is in the United States. BYD says it's scoping out for a new factory in central Mexico, but it has assured everybody that it is not going to use that factory to export into United States.
At least not yet.
At least not yet. But Jorge Eduardo makes the very interesting point that the Chinese have way more capacity than they need domestically to serve the entire global market. And so this overbuilding of factories is something that a lot of people think is just crazy because, again, China's capacity is already so large and shipping cars from China is something that's already done quite well. Some other people suggest that one of the reasons why all of these auto companies are setting up factories in Argentina, in so many different countries around the world, is because they want to sanction-proof their business in the event that the United States starts lobbying sanctions against made-in-China products. These products that are then made in other countries can circumvent the sanctions. And of course, that is why people are so up in arms over these new Mexican factories. When Americans come to you to ask you, you know, Lei, what do I need to know about these Chinese auto factories in Mexico? Are they going to come into the United States with vehicles that are duty-free under the United States-Canada-Mexico trade agreement? Or are these going to be used for the Central American market as the Chinese say they are? What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them yes, eventually.
You think Chinese cars are coming into the U.S. eventually?
It's a matter of time.
And you think American consumers will buy a Chinese car?
Yeah, definitely. I will. But I'm Chinese, so... But
yeah, you're a little more sophisticated. I wonder if that same nationalism that you're seeing in China would also apply in the United States as well.
Yeah, so let's update some of the recent news that I've got to know. So maybe pick out a couple of examples. And BYD and NIO would be two great examples because they have had entities in the U.S., in California, Los Angeles, right? For probably at least a decade, both companies, and to prepare kind of the entry into the U.S. But recently, BYD America CEO Stella Lee has gone on the record saying that they don't have plan to enter the U.S., at least not yet. So I keep that, you know, a grain of salt. And the NIO has already, what I've gotten to know is that they've taken out that U.S. market out of that 25 countries by 2025 boilerplate. But that does not mean that they will never try to come in. It's just given the current geopolitical and the relationship environment, I think they're just holding off. And going back to Mexico, there is that USMCA agreement in place. So as any company, well, let's, you know, our strategies is try to use that to our benefit. And I think that's what many of these Chinese automakers are doing. But there's several directions or aims for building up shop in Mexico. One is, in fact, the access to the USMCA free trade agreement, potentially going into the U.S. And second, as a hub for the entire Americas region. So I think both of these factors, and for now, it's probably U.S. is in the back burner a little bit. I think everybody's watching the election. And, you know, you play that clip of Trump. And what I thought was interesting was one thing he mentioned was building in Mexico, not using American workers. So I'm even thinking maybe, you know, Trump gets elected, he would be even more pro than Biden of what if China builds in the U.S.? But obviously that's going to get like a whole different, congressional.
The problem is that the president actually doesn't have that much power in these discussions. First of all, Trump does not have the authority to impose tariffs on these products because under the free trade agreement, you cannot do that. So you would be torpedoing the largest free trade agreement in the world if he was to start putting these kinds of tariffs on. And then the other point is the Biden administration, which has actually in many ways been tougher on China than the Trump administration, is talking about banning Chinese cars, not because of the subsidies, but more related to what we're talking about with TikTok, which is on the national security grounds, on the data privacy and the fact that all the data that cars generate is going to be managed by the Chinese and doesn't have the transparency. Again, a lot of the same arguments we're hearing in the TikTok debate. So watch if Biden and his team win the election, probably going to be tougher on China on cars than Trump is my guess. Because Trump has already indicated that he's not going to be tough on TikTok. And so if the Senate's going to pass this TikTok law, they're going to have to do it possibly before the election because if not a guarantee that Trump is going to do that. And he probably may not be as tough on Chinese cars either.
Yeah. So going back to, earlier of Trump's also that alliance of American manufacturing, the existential threat versus Guardado's position. I said I'm somewhere in the middle. So meaning all of these, flood, bloodbath, the threat is definitely there. Let's, that's full stop. But is it going to be a bloodbath? Is it flooding? That hasn't happened yet. And I don't think it'll happen like a bloodbath because the indigenous brands, China EVs, first of all, they're not here. They haven't come in yet. They're outside the door watching, trying to set foot, but they haven't come in yet. So everything I believe is in the current environment, in the current election year, is disguised simply as protectionism. And I think everything is overblown a little bit.
Yeah, this is a bad year to do good analysis like this because of so much hyperbole on all sides.
Yeah, I mean, if you read that statement from Biden that White House put out, the first two sentences, I laughed because it started off saying I have nothing against the American auto workers, but the first sentence said American auto workers are the best in the world.
Well, what do you think he's going to say? I mean, he's not going to say that the German auto workers are the best in the world.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that statement that put out was clearly directed at voters in the swing states.
Of course.
And the security concern, the sensors. I mean, cars are becoming that way anyways all over the world.
Yeah, and the data management, though, is a legitimate concern, though. I mean, I think countries are allowed to manage their people's data. And by the way, China has those same restrictions as well. All data must be localized in China and not sent overseas. So when Ford sets up its factories and its cars and its data processing, it must be processed within the boundaries of China. So not an unreasonable requirement.
Yeah, and Tesla has gone on record saying that the cars in China, the data are stayed in China.
Let's look overseas a little bit further. And in places like here in Southeast Asia, one of the appeals of Chinese EVs is that they provide mobility throughout the entire transport chain. So BYD, in fact, is now getting into electric scooters. And the Chinese have been amazing in the electric scooter market. And I remember back, 15 years ago when I was in China, and there was just tons of bicycles and gas-powered scooters. And then over a pace of like 5 years, all of the gas-powered scooters just disappeared and everything was electric. And it is remarkable how the cities are just so quiet. I mean, in fact, it's one of the things that I hate the most about living in China is the fact that there are rules for everything in China. But for some reason, the electric scooters and the delivery guys can go on the opposite side of the road and go anywhere they want, and you don't hear them coming. And I can't tell you how many times I've almost lost my life to these guys because I wasn't hearing them coming and they were coming the wrong way. But it is a real reflection of how the entire transportation chain has been electrified from scooters to tricycles to the small wheeling cars all the way up to the luxury cars, trucks, buses, you name it, they've electrified it. In countries like Zimbabwe and Indonesia and here in Vietnam, that is very appealing. Now, in these countries, the question of indigenous auto sectors is not the same issue because there isn't large indigenous auto sectors. Vietnam's starting to get one, but Zimbabwe, for example, doesn't have one. Kenya does not have one. So the idea of subsidized cars is great. It's fantastic. And it also reduces these countries' oil import bill. So there's a lot of pluses for electrifying in developing countries. But talk to us about how you see the Chinese strategies in terms of going global, particularly at that low end of the market, the bottom of the pyramid that's so appealing to people in developing countries.
Yeah, I think that's where the opportunity is in Southeast Asia.
Well, there's no competition from the Germans or competition from the Germans or the Americans are not producing at that bottom of the market. The Indians are a little bit like Tata, correct?
Yeah, going back to e-scooters, I wanted to share my experience. So having spent 2 months in Beijing last summer, I felt like I was in a Southeast Asia country because in the intersections, the cars have to wait when the light turns green. The other direction, all of these e-scooters, you have to wait for them to go through before you can go. So that was something because I haven't been back to China since the pandemic. And that was like the biggest difference I saw. But anyways, going back, we leave Europe, we leave the US for a minute. And if we talk about the other parts of the world, right, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, I think our opportunities, not only in terms of market perspective, but capital perspective, you're seeing these capital coming out of, you know, Saudi Arabia, UAE, into China EV companies. And Southeast Asia is, I think, these traditional Japanese brands are getting, I wouldn't say a bloodbath, but this competition from the China EVs, I think the headwind is pretty strong.
Be careful here, though. Let me challenge you, push back on that point there, because, again, I'll use where I live in Vietnam. There's no charging infrastructure here, okay? So a hybrid car makes a lot of sense where you get a little bit of the benefit of the EV and you don't have to rely on a charging network. And that's where Toyota has put its money. And Toyota is a huge player in Southeast Asia, for example. I mean, they're a huge player worldwide, but especially here. And they've said it's going to take decades to get the charging infrastructure up in some of the world's poorest countries, which, by the way, are also some of the highest growth countries in terms of population. So the market may not be in fully electrified transportation, but in partial electrification. What's your thought on that?
I think even in China, if we look at the growth of the NEV, because when we talk about NEVs, there's two things, right? There's the plug-ins and then there's the battery electric vehicles. Actually, the growth over the last couple of years have come from these plug-ins or extended range vehicles. So I think you're going to see, you know, I was in Germany last week, right? And I saw this BYD store in Stuttgart. And the four vehicles on display there are all the pure battery electric vehicles. And the associates was telling me they're bringing more the so-called DMI, which is BYD's own proprietary plug-in models. So I think you're going to see more of that in other parts of the world, probably including Southeast Asia, to address what you just described, the particular models that are fit for the particular market at obviously competitive prices. But then again, right, we're only talking about importing, exporting these vehicles into the market, but the climate, the after-sales service, these needs to be built out, right? And it's going to take a long process. And so far, I think going back to that threat, overblown a little bit, you know, I was in Germany and frankly, the volumes are not there, and EU is talking about this injury. I don't see any injury.
You mean the volumes of Chinese cars are not there, or the volumes of EVs?
The volumes of Chinese EVs, or cars, for that matter.
Well, no, because I think they're concerned right now. I mean, BYD is building a plant in Hungary. They're coming, and that's why the Europeans now really want to make a decision if they're going to block this or they're going to let them in, because I think they're concerned that if they let them in, once you let them in, you can't get them back out again.
Yeah, so hence, you know, this retroactive tariffs that are possibly being placed. However many of these vehicles that are now being registered, right, this new registration process that EU just announced, that tariffs will probably eventually go up. And likewise in the US, we've heard about 100% tariffs being thrown out.
Well, right now it's at 27.5 in the US. and they're thinking about increasing that and just doing an outright ban. So one country that I want to draw everybody's attention to, if you want to see how the competition is playing out, focus on what's happening in South Africa, because this is where the Chinese are going head to head with the Japanese, Koreans, and the Europeans, as well as the Americans. And boy, they are fighting a good fight. Their cars are getting really, really well reviewed in some of the most competitive regional markets in South Africa. And South Africa, in many ways, is the most advanced auto market in Africa. And you talked about sales and service. When you drive around Johannesburg and Pretoria, you see Haval, the service centers, you see Chery, they're all there. And so I think, again, if we want to see what the future in the Global South looks like for this competition among the great powers and their auto companies, South Africa is definitely a leading indicator, and it shows you that the Chinese brands can compete head-on with the Japanese and some of the well-established incumbent players in this market. Okay, let's wrap up our discussion looking ahead through the rest of this year. We are in this election year in the United States. We're seeing this big push internationally. Are we at risk maybe of a bubble in terms of the Chinese and their overcapacity? Again, we mentioned they've got too much capacity at home. They're building all of these factories overseas. We talked about in Thailand, they can now produce right now 730,000 EVs for a market that's not even buying a seventh of that. What's going on here? Have people lost their minds, or are they seeing something that we just aren't in terms of the upgrowth of EV adoption in Global South markets?
I'd say it's looking much farther ahead, planning. And at the end of the day, I think this year will be the start of a year. You know, bloodbath, I think the current price war is in fact a bloodbath, because that bloodbath will lead to quite a few. And recently, I think you've seen some brands under pressure of either being bought, exiting, or altogether. So I think this process is probably going to make the strong stronger and weed out the weaker. And finally, I think that's happening. At the same time, what I mentioned, that you're still seeing these new brands launching. NIO is launching two brands. XPeng is launching another brand. Xiaomi is launching. Chery's got some new brands. So I think this is a huge bet on China's part, on some of these companies. And I think it's the last hurdle, basically. If they don't get it right, and even for the foreign car makers, I think you may see some of the mass market brands exit the China market.
Oh, I think that's for sure. That is definitely going to happen. There's no doubt. So if you live outside the United States, you probably will have an opportunity to enjoy a ride in a Chinese-made EV. You'll see them on the roads in Ubers, and here in Southeast Asia, maybe Gojeks and Grabs will start to have more of them. Sadly, if you're in the United States, you'll miss it. And I say sadly only because, man, the tech in a lot of these cars is just badass. I mean, it's just amazing, some of the tech that they have. And I've been blown away. And I used to work in the Chinese auto market, and I loved going to the auto shows just to see all the crazy stuff that they put in their cars. But it is amazing. And if you're a gadget geek, then you love this business. And by the way, if you're a gadget geek, you're going to want to follow Lei Xing and the great work he's doing on the China EVs and More podcast. This is a fantastic show. It's helped inform me in my understanding of this. I'm a huge fan. Lei, if people want to subscribe to the podcast and follow the work you're doing, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. You can sign up and listen to China EVs and More. It's on all the podcast platforms. And, you know, speaking of, auto show, it's coming up in a month. I'm going back, and I'm really looking forward to learn. The way I guess I would describe is the development is so fast that what I experienced last summer would normally be like a generation older. That's how it feels.
It's going that fast. So when you're back at the auto show, let me give you a piece of advice, because I used to go to these all the time. There's the main floor where everybody has all their cool stuff and all the big players are there. But way in the back, in the corner somewhere, you have the much smaller brands that are specifically targeted for overseas markets and developing countries in particular. And they don't have the money to be in the main floor. And what is fascinating, though, is that you see what the Chinese have done in telecommunications and in so many other products, where they customize and tailor these products for the needs of these very, very large markets, but not very lucrative markets. The profit margins selling to Africa and Southeast Asia and South Asia are very, very low. But for example, they would have these electric vehicles that had the battery packs higher so that in monsoon seasons they could run. And so the electric system was above the water line. And you're thinking to yourself, that is amazing. I mean, that's just incredible thinking and innovation on their part. So do me a favor. We're going to follow up with you after you go to the show. Would love to hear your impressions and see some of the photos that you take of the coolest new entrants into the market. And this is going to be something we follow for a while.
I think one thing is not only about how these China EV Inc., I would say, are growing and iterating, developing fast. But I think the other theme that I'm looking forward to is how these foreign legacies are fighting back.
Yeah.
I think there will be some announcements, the Volkswagens, because they're not technically out of it, because they're kind of waiting. Some are participating, but I think their stance is out of the bloodbath, and some of these Chinese companies will probably exit, and then we're going to pounce. I think that's kind of the theme that I'm looking forward to, besides the products. Yeah.
Okay. Lei Xing, once again, is the host of the China EVs and More podcast, also an independent consultant in the Chinese automotive sector. He's been doing this for a long time. He's the former chief editor of the China Automotive Review, and also just a great source of information on this topic. Lei, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Big fan of your platform as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And if you guys would like to subscribe and support the work that we're doing, it's so important. We want to thank everybody in our Patreon community for their support of the China Global South Project, and also all of our new readers from around the world. We've had a nice little uptick recently in subscriptions. We want to thank all of our new subscribers and welcome everybody to the platform. If you'd like to join our reader community, go to ChinaGlobalSouth.com/subscribe. Subscriptions are very affordable. And if you are a student or a teacher, just email me, Eric@ChinaGlobalSouth.com, and I'll send you a link for a half off discount, just $10 a month for a subscription. And you'll get thousands of articles, our own AI large language model engine that we've got going, exclusive videos from the team all over the world. And we are covering this EV battery story, the critical mineral story, and the EV story all over the Global South in depth. Anytime there's news, this is the great place to get it. So that'll do it for this edition of the show. I'll be back again next week with Giraud and Kobus and the rest of the team. Until then, I'm Eric Olander in Ho Chi Minh City. Thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Follow the China Global South Project on Twitter @ChinaGSProject and share your thoughts on today's show, or head over to our website at ChinaGlobalSouth.com, where you can subscribe to receive full access to more than 5,000 articles and podcasts. Once again, that's ChinaGlobalSouth.com.